Clubhouse today. So it was pretty good. Good, man.
It was cool. I mean, yeah, one issue is like my brain is wired for podcasts now. And so the speed at which people talk really psychs me out, especially if you're not involved in the conversation. Like if you're involved in it, it's just like doing a podcast, right? So you don't really notice it because you're thinking and processing in real time. But like, I was just listening to one with like Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt afterwards, right? Just like talking about the coddling of the American mind and stuff. Yeah, it's just like random people on it all the time.
That's really cool. And like and people who have interesting things to say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. There's a great one by like Barry Weiss and Caitlin Flanagan last night, just talking about like, you know, all the stuff that they've been dealing with recently. Some interesting stuff today. Sam Harris is doing something tomorrow night, actually. He's like on it finally. So dude, you gotta just set it up, man.
And it's iPad or Apple only, I guess, hey? So
yeah.
So what were people talking about? Like what were you listening to today?
Today was just like they were talking about how their views on like the coddling in the American mind has changed over time. And so, you know, they published like, Jonathan Haidt and Greg published that book in like 2016 or something. So they were just like talking about, how some of the data has like changed over time. And like the mental health stuff's still a big issue, but, some of their others, yeah, complaints have diminished over time. But, I wasn't like, yeah, too invested in that one, but it's like, you know, it's like just one of those things that's worth having, I think. Like every once in a while, there'll be like an interesting conversation or you want to like take part in a conversation. I don't think Logan thinks it'll like completely replace like Twitter and other forms of social media, which I doubt. I'm less skeptical of that. But I think it's just what you said in the social media episode. Like there was a niche to be filled, right? And it was that niche was like real-time audio conversations. And like, of course, in retrospect, that makes complete sense. Like sometimes people want to hash things out in real time and they want other people listening. And there's no reason you can't do sort of a live podcasting thing. I don't think it'll take over podcasting because a lot of people want like, one, you have the speed thing. They would just want time to like pause it and reflect on it and listen to it again. And you can't always get that with Clubhouse, right? So there's like a digestible element with podcasts that you don't have with Clubhouse, but it's totally just filling like a niche for people to sit around and listen to live conversation and like while you're doing the dishes and not have to be there. And so, yeah, it's cool to see. Just
I was going to say, you're fucking Twitter warrior, though. I've like really yeah, I'm going hard, tweets, man. It's so good.
I'm ripping.
It's like, are you finding like you're getting into some interesting conversations and stuff? Like, for networking purposes, has it been?
Man, not yet. I'm just hoping that if I keep tweeting interesting things, I'll eventually have like enough people who are on the lookout that that'll generate interesting conversation. I feel like you have to, you got to like overcome the inertia of just being like another random person on Twitter. You know, I have to like make enough people aware of me that people actually care to look. You know, because like,
dude,
also it's
it.
Fucking hard to get followers on Twitter, dude. Like, it's so fucking hard.
Twitter, I basically just use it for input and then like machine learning output. But
that makes sense.
But for networking and stuff, it's been kind of useful. But I was like, because you have probably two audiences, right? Like, you have the EA space, and now you have the critical rationalist space. And like, are you finding much cross? Over like there's like Mauricio and Dan who are starting to get into both worlds, but like are people starting to notice like your critical rationalist side in the EA land or not really?
I don't know, it's a good question. I think the EAs are just like kind of fed up with me, actually. I think people are just kind of like, oh, this fucking guy.
Because you had like a giant Facebook debate with like all of Oxford for a bit.
Oh yeah, that was good. Yeah, I just think, I mean, changing minds is really hard. Like, it's a really hard thing. And so I think most of the people are like, I think some people are just like fed up with it. Like, especially the Stanford people, I get the sense they're just like, shut the fuck up. And so now I don't engage that much. And yeah, I don't know. I feel like they're kind of sick of my shit. And then the Oxford people, I'm just kind of losing touch with them because, you know, I don't live in the UK anymore. I think they like know, my views now. And so
you can only really say it once or twice.
Yeah.
You can't force people to listen. And,
yeah, like, exactly.
Because when I posted the piece into the EA forum, like the follow-up piece, 5 responses, like no one really engaged too much.
Exactly.
Which is, I think it's fine. Like, we can't force people to listen to us. I'm going to finish this stupid little series that I promised now.
Nice.
But it'll be on the internet, and I'm glad it exists. And if people don't want to discuss it right now, then we can't force anyone to, obviously. But also, I think just like it takes years for ideas to sink in. And so we shouldn't expect things to change after like one or two posts or podcasts. Like, this is going to take bloody years for the ideas to kind of sink in a bit.
That's exactly right. It's like, yeah, the first time you're saying stuff, you get lots of engagement and people are like, whoa, this is crazy, we're gonna argue. And then it's like the follow-up stuff, they're just like, oh, shut up, like, we get it. I'm still gonna say my piece, but whatever.
Say it to those who ask, and then we'll just we gotta keep moving on. I'm gonna grab another beer, and then let's get into the first chapter.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to explain just what the hell this stupid concept is, because I think it's like the linchpin concept to understanding like all of Popper's work. Mm. And have you Googled the Wikipedia article on scientific laws?
No.
You should look at this, because talking about how deep the misconceptions about science run, read the first sentence of the Wikipedia page about scientific laws. So scientific laws or laws of science are statements based on repeated experiment or observation that describe or predict a range of natural phenomena. And then later on, it says, like, laws differ from theories in that they do not posit a mechanism or explanation of phenomena. They are merely distillations of the results of repeated observation.
Wow.
And this is the Wikipedia page for what a scientific law is. And this is completely wrong. It's completely wrong. And the reason why Popper has focused on the problem of induction in like probably a half to like a third of his books is because of how deeply this misconception runs throughout the entire world. And I very rarely have an objection to a Wikipedia page, but if listeners could see your face right now, they would realize how bad it is, right?
Wow. Yeah. It's so steeped in verificationism, and like, hypotheses and postulates are not laws. They have not been verified to the same degree. Wow.
So I want to try to convey what the problem of induction is to listeners so that they can be as horrified about the Wikipedia article as you and I are, and then also recognize how deeply these misconceptions go and how widespread and global they are. And so I was like on a walk with Helena just before this conversation, and I tried out my example. So let me try it out on you. So like, the setup is you're playing poker and you are trying to figure out if your opponent is bluffing or not. Let's say that you're trying to infer a tell. So let's say every time I'm bluffing, I start to sweat. And so you see me sweat and then I bluff. And then you see me sweat and then I bluff. And then you want to try to figure out what's going on behind the surface, the deeper principle that would be something like, every time Vaden sweats, he's bluffing. And this is what human beings are trying to do all of the time. We're trying to go from some observations. So an observation is that I sweat, then I bluff, and I sweat, then I bluff, to some deeper general principle. The other example I was thinking of, because I was like, when you learn about the problem of induction, it's always like talking about swans and Socrates. And so I think that, like, that's not the most useful way to convey how important this problem is. And so I thought a more contemporary example was The Bachelor. So I've been watching The Bachelor quite a lot recently.
Do you bet on it? That's a fun thing to do.
No, yeah, but Helena... but okay, so betting on The Bachelor is a perfect example of what we're talking about when we're talking about the problem of induction. Because what you, the viewer, is trying to do is you're trying to see who he's going to pick. And you're trying to ascertain clues that can be generalized to give you some general principle. Like, if he laughs at her joke, then he's not going to send her home or something. And you're trying to find some pattern in his behavior that allows you to extrapolate about what's going to happen in the future, right? And so the problem of induction is the fact that this is a logically invalid thing to do, but yet we are all trying to do it all of the time. This is just the default state, is we're trying to go from observations to something more general, something deeper, more universal, that gives us dominion over our environment, gives us some predictive power, gives us some deeper understanding. And induction is logically invalid, meaning it doesn't matter how many times I sweat before I bluff. It could be the case that I sweat and I'm not bluffing, right? And contrast it to deduction, where deduction is logically valid. So deduction would be, let's just assume the truth of the general thing. So the general thing is, when Vaden sweats, he's bluffing. Or when Vaden's bluffing, he sweats. And then from that, you can concatenate that with another observation statement, like Vaden is sweating. And then you can deduce something useful and true and important and helpful, which is that Vaden is bluffing. So deduction is going like from the general thing to the specific thing. And that is completely logically valid. There's no, if the assumptions are true, then the conclusion will be true. So the problem of induction is the fact that people think we get our knowledge through inductive inference, which is going from observations to the more general thing. Yet inductive inference is logically invalid because there could always be something that doesn't fit. And yet human beings are doing this all the time. When we're watching TV, when we're playing poker, and the reason why the poker analogy, I think, is clarifying is because in reality, we are trying to ascertain what the deeper principles are behind the observations. And all we ever get are observations, but we're trying to figure out the deeper principle. And so the classic, quote, problem of induction is just that the whole world, including Wikipedia, thinks that this is how we get our knowledge, but yet it's logically invalid. And the reason why I claim this is like the most important Popperian concept to grok first, before falsification, before any other thing that comes from Popper, is that he solved this problem simply by saying, we never can induce general principles from observations. All we can ever do is conjecture the general principle and then deductively infer the consequences. So I'm going to conjecture that Vaden sweats when he bluffs. And then the consequence of that would be he's sweating, therefore he's bluffing. And then you can check your consequence against reality, which is, I'm going to go all in, and holy shit, he wasn't bluffing. So therefore, my conjecture was false. And that's Popper's solution to the classic problem of induction. And that's why the title of the book is Conjectures and Refutations, and that's why falsification falls out, and this is why he focuses on the problem of induction and like the logic of scientific discovery and realism and the aim of science and objective knowledge. And like, it's always like the first thing he discusses in his books. And it's so widely not appreciated that if you have read Popper and you understand how simple and elegant his solution is, and then you read Wikipedia and you're like, why have you not understood this simple thing that he's been saying for the last 100 years? You will start to become as irritated by these Wikipedia articles as you and I are. I don't know. So that's my attempted explanation of the problem of induction. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, that was fantastic. There's a bunch of stuff came to mind there. One is that you provided a very elegant visualization, I think, of induction versus deduction. So like, if you picture a funnel? No, what's the thing that like goes from wide to skinny? Like funnel, you like pour liquids through or something. Yeah, funnel. Yeah, sure, a funnel. Yeah, it starts wide and it gets skinny. deduction is the funnel the right way up, right? So it's wide at the top and skinny at the bottom, and so you're starting from the more general, right? So and these more general just take the form of like premises, and then you take these premises and you do some logical operations on them. That's like them going through the funnel, and you get out like a more specific statement that you have inferred, you have deduced from the general. Induction, the problem of induction is like flipping the funnel upside down, and you're starting from specific statements. So these small specific statements, and what you're trying to get out the other end is this broad generalization of these statements that somehow ties them together. So you see a couple specific phenomenon. You see the sun rising every morning for 5 mornings in a row, and then you ask yourself, how can I justify this belief that the sun's going to rise 6 days in a row? So I see, yeah, the classic example, like you said, is swans, which we have to talk about. We can't talk about induction. We don't talk about swans. Yeah, how are people going to understand Nassim Taleb and his fucking black swan thing if we don't talk about swans? Oh my God, we're doing such a disservice. the classic example is like, you see 1,000 swans. I don't know where you're walking, but you see 1,000 swans, but swans are numerous in this location. And you see 1,000 swans. And then the question is like, well, we all want to say that the 1,001st swan is going to be white. I mean, my God, we've just seen 1,000 swans. So what logical operation, what principle allows you to be justified in saying this? And as you said, this has been like, people have fought over this for like hundreds of years and still fight over it now. Like, you still find tons of blog posts on like the problem of induction. And it's just this question of like, what justifies us in this belief, in saying that the 1,001st swan is going to be white based on the fact that we've seen 1,000 white swans up till now. And Popper comes along and does what he always does so well. And he just says, guys, he just flips the problem. He's like, this is a pseudo problem. There is no justification, right? All there is us just conjecturing that. It doesn't matter where this conjecture came from. It could be that your grandma told you. We don't care. You're just going to say all swans are white. And then we're going to see if we're wrong, right? So it's just like this importing this method of trial and error into this process, instead of trying to find a super justified reason for believing the 1,001st swan is white. And So this is a move Popper just does over and over again, where he just replaces the question with a better question. Mm-hmm. And also he takes as evidence the fact that like, if people can't solve a problem for like hundreds of years, maybe it's the wrong problem to ask. Maybe it's a pseudo problem. Maybe it's a non-existent problem.
So Helena, when I had, when I tried out the poker example, instantly she's like, oh yeah, obviously you could never be certain that sweating equals bluffing. And so she immediately got to the place of like, yeah, you can never be certain about it. And that use of the word certainty is where the Bayesian probabilistic solution to the problem of induction comes in. Because sure, you can never be certain of the conclusion, but perhaps you can say that the conclusion holds with high probability. And then you get the probabilistic solution to the problem of induction coming in, where they say, okay, perhaps it's not absolutely the case that when you sweat, you're bluffing, but it could be the case with high probability that when you sweat, you bluff. And so the probabilistic solution to the problem of induction is one that's still very widely held in my own field and is what a lot of researchers are banking on that's going to get us to AGI, which is, while it might not be the case that we can infer with absolute 100% confidence and certainty laws of nature, we can get them probabilistically. And this turns out to also not work at all, for reasons which I will not go into here. But
and also for reasons that Bayesians don't seem to care about. Yeah. I don't get it. I don't understand what's going on. Like, I'm like an evangelist for your, yeah, for anyone. Vaden has like a super nice piece on his website that is like a very clear articulation of the impossibility of probabilistic induction. And the first time I read this, I found it, like, this is so compelling. This is amazing. The world needs to know about this. And so, of course, when I got Twitter and my Twitter warrior self, like, I started tweeting this at everyone. Like, take this, take that, you know, thinking I was just going to be changing the world. All these Bayesians were going to be going, oh my God, and be repenting their errors and like starting to read conjecture reputations. And like, no one gives a shit. I don't get it. Like, it's like, I'm telling you, I'm showing you this thing is impossible. Like, using your own tools, this is your own math. And it's like, not possible. And people are just like, eh. Just fucking insane, man. Yeah. They're like, well, my credence and your credence is low, so I don't care.
So I guess we should say we're talking about the first chapter in Conjectures and Refutations. And the chapter is split into two pieces. The second piece is the harder piece, and that's all about the problem of induction. But the first piece is about falsification, and that's Popper's, like, the thing that people know him for, and we'll go into it in some more detail, but if we are successful, falsification should just be seen as a trivial consequence of the deeper problem which Popper solved, which is the problem of induction.
It struck me as you were talking that I hadn't made the connection before between Hume's empiricism and his identification of the problem of induction, but it makes perfect sense, right? Because if you're an empiricist and you believe you think that we can only gather knowledge by means of observations of things, of course you have to wonder, like, how on earth are we developing general laws about things that seem to hold because we can only view finitely many things in our life, right? Like, we've only been alive for so long, and so how is it possible that these finite observations we're making are leading to, like, these incredibly general laws? So, I didn't actually make that connection between his empiricism and his identification of the two problems of induction. One is the logical one that we've been talking about, and then one is the psychological one, which, you know, he posits as distinct from the logical one. The psychological one is, like, fine, the problem of induction seems to be hard, right? There seems to be no logical solution to it, but humans do this anyway. We're, like, coming up with general laws all the time. And of course, as we just said, Popper thinks, no, that's not what we're doing. We're making wild guesses and then refuting them. But for Hume, I now understand, like, the driving force behind these two problems. Cause, like, of course, if you're an empiricist, then they kind of naturally fall out of that doctrine.
And we should say that empiricism was very necessary to repudiate religious authority, right? Where the belief that we get knowledge from observation is far superior to the belief that we get knowledge through revelation, which was the regnant belief at the time. And Hume also wrote some beautiful critiques of religion and miracles. So in that piece, he has, like, three characters all debating the nature of God's existence. And it was actually published post-Humeus. What do you call it when you publish something after
posthumously?
Death? Posthumous, but it's David Hume posting it. So does it posthumously? I don't know.
Hume posthumously. Yeah. Oh my god!
After Hume's death, this was posted, and so it just goes to show that his empiricism, like, actually served as a very valuable critique of beliefs that were held at the time, right? And his,
nice,
his dialogue concerning natural religion is super readable, and I would actually recommend that one to listeners. But again, like a good rationalist, like someone who takes seriously counter-arguments to their cherished position, he talked about the problem of induction and didn't really have a solution to it. We should say that it wasn't only that it was logically impossible, but it also led to circularities as well. So a common way out of the problem of induction is to posit some inductive rule, or some principle of induction that says, like, the future will resemble the past, or the seen will resemble the unseen, or something. So then the logical statements would be something like, assuming that the future will resemble the past, and given that we've observed Vaden sweating and bluffing many times, then it is the case that Vaden sweats when he bluffs. But the circularity is precisely in the fact that you would need to inductively infer the principle of induction, the statement that the future will resemble the past. And as soon as you try to say, well, where did that principle come from, then there's no way from an inductive perspective to get there. And so you get a circularity.
Yeah, nice.
And that was, in essence, Hume's refutation of this idea that you can learn from induction, and therein lies the problem of induction. But again, I guess it is a real problem in the sense that people thought that that was where you got your knowledge, but it's not a problem anymore. It's a solved problem.
Except no one believes that it is. Yeah. I was just going to say, if you, dear listener, are convinced that it is a non-problem, which you should be, you will be startled to find when you scour the internet that like no one takes the solution seriously and everyone just continues on their merry way arguing about induction. And so Popper has this nice quote in here that he says the belief that science proceeds from observation to theory is still so widely and so firmly held that my denial of it is often met with incredulity. I have even been suspected of being insincere, of denying what nobody in his senses doubts. And this is like equally true today. people still are just like, oh, shut up with your little non-induction problem. You can't just wish the problem away. That's not how science works. And then they proceed to argue about probability and things.
The only time you could ever like read in David Deutsch's writing that he's like actively annoyed is when he's talking about induction.
Yeah.
It brings out the angry David Deutsch. But it's so frustrating when like the solution is contained in the title of his book, Conjectures and Refutations, but people again just ignore it.
It's interesting. So Hume, I think, sort of descended into irrationality near the end of his life. So you know, he couldn't find this principle that would allow us to logically validate induction, and so he kind of said, well, that's where just humans are irrational, and that's it. And you can feel, it's interesting when you read it, I really felt Popper's emotionality coming out when he was like, really, he's constantly fighting against this tendency of like relativism and irrationality. And I think part of it is because his sort of epistemology and his philosophy can often be conflated with a kind of relativism because he doesn't adhere to like certain sort of like very common tropes of rationality and like empiricism and stuff. And so I think he was like maybe often accused of sort of being irrational or something. And so you can feel him when you're reading this, like fighting against that. We just have to like throw out irrationality and stuff. So you can feel him fighting against this. And then he, you know, proposes a solution, which is that we like come up with these guesses and then we just have them refuted by observation. So observation doesn't play the leading role in developing the theories, it plays the refuting role. So it's like it's sort of a role reversal. But what I love, right, is that like at the end of the chapter, he starts talking about like the importance of like myth making and guesswork and creativity. And these are just like tendencies, I think, that are so often ignored back then, but also now by like typically people who like would call themselves rationalists or like the Bay Area rationalist community, right? Popper is explicitly endorses like myth making as this fantastic human endeavor that is a result of humans' unique capability to be creative and guess wild shit. So, you know, it's the rationality kicks in when we have our guesses refuted by reality and we slowly converge on the best guess. And then we start to call those theories and hypotheses and laws, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I just love how he sort of like nods his head towards like, you know, cultures and just like myths of every style. And sort of he doesn't. There's like, I don't know, this weird sort of scientism type of attitude where it's just like, oh, myth making, that's not science, or like things like this. And no, that is the human process of coming up with knowledge. It's like we conjecture crazy shit and who knows where it came from, right? And all these amazing myths that we hear of from like different cultures and, you know, and previous generations of humans were like fantastic examples of just like what our creativity is capable of. And so I don't know, I just, yeah, it's a lovely sort of convergence of like just humanity and creativity and rationality at the end that just like is always a delight to read.
And it dissolves the boundary between, say, science fiction, journalism, and fiction, and history, and all forms of human expression can contribute to our understanding. And so it isn't like there's this hard and fast distinction between nonfiction and fiction when it comes to knowledge, because it's all myth-making. And it, maybe the one difference between fiction and nonfiction is just different stages of the myth. Like some science fiction can influence science and it just dissolves all the boundaries, which I love. It isn't like we can only look to the mathematicians for truth. The mathematicians and the artists are all contributing to the myths in their own ways. And what matters is tempering it by criticism in this evolutionary way. But again, it's this like unity of knowledge point, which is, I think, so important to recognize that it's not just people with PhDs in the ivory tower who
exactly
have knowledge. It's journalists, it's bloggers, it's anyone who can creatively contribute to the pool of ideas. And in that sense, we're all equal contributors to the share of myths. Yeah.
Exactly. Your idea will be proved wrong, and then mine will be proved wrong, but it doesn't matter. They'll all be proved wrong eventually. Yeah, and that's just like the pursuit of knowledge, right? Is we're all just coming up with crazy guesses and then slowly converging on truth. It's just, it's so refreshing to read, you know, it's amazing.
It's beautiful.
Okay, fine. Now I'm ready to actually return to the first part of the chapter.
Well, maybe what you want to set up, because you said you had some ideas.
I would love to talk to Popper about this part of the chapter, actually, because it bugs me a little bit. So Popper, I think we'll get into this later in like chapter 2 and chapter 3, he's like a bone to pick with essentialism, which is just the idea that like words and concepts have an absolutely essential meaning. And that we're trying to, when we talk about them, we're trying to uncover that meaning. They have something that's like beyond, like language is not just instrumental. There's an essential concept there. When you talk about justice or something, right? There's like an essence to the word justice. It's not just like a useful concept that we like bend to our will in order to like talk about various things. There's like this thing called justice, and we're just like mere humans trying to access it. And I have the sense reading the first part of the chapter that he's doing this a bit with like science and metaphysics. Actually, he's like, so when you state, okay, so just fucking set up the first part of this chapter where he's trying to demarcate between science and non-science, or science and metaphysics. And what I'd want to ask him is like, what is going on here? Are you just assuming that like people kind of know what you mean when you say science and when you say non-science? Are you using science as like a stand-in for like just things that, you know, have some predictive power, and that when we use them to make, you know, we're using them sometimes to make predictions about how the world works, and we're just trying to sort through which of these disciplines is like more useful than other ones. So there's all these disciplines in front of us. They make predictions. Now we're just trying to sort through which of these are like useful predictions. Or are you saying there's like something essential about science?
Oh, nice. Interesting. Just maybe not disagreement, but like, so, to set up the first half of the chapter for the, audience, he is discussing his experience when he was younger, thinking about three dominant theories in the culture in 1919. And so the big three theories that he was discussing and thinking about were Einstein's theory of special and general relativity, Karl Marx's theory of Marxism,
dialectical materialism,
materialism and scientific socialism and all that, and then psychoanalysis. So both Freud and Adler, and so just let's drop the phrase science entirely. I don't think there's anything essential going on. So we'll just use the word science. Let's just say here are three theories. What distinguishes Einstein's theory from these others, or put a different way, what is the difference between astronomy and astrology? Right. And so one thing that people thought at the time was that Einstein, Freud, and Marx were all equally valid science. So they were valid because of the confirming evidence that was constantly being introduced and met. So every time a Marxist would open the paper and a factory would revolt, that was evidence of the bourgeoisie hegemony finally showing strains of weakness. But yeah. If a factory didn't revolt, it was because capitalism was so deeply entrenched into the hearts and minds of the workers that they didn't yet have class consciousness and weren't yet able to break the shackles of their bondage.
Yeah.
And so whether a factory revolted or didn't revolt was both equally confirming of the truth of Marxism. Same with Freudian psychoanalysis. So there's a nice quote that he has. He says the following. So I may illustrate this, where this is the fact that these theories can be confirmed by anything, using two very different examples of human behavior. That of a man who pushes a child into the water with the intention of drowning it, and that of a man who sacrifices his life in an attempt to save the child. So couldn't be more opposite examples of human behavior. And he says that each of these cases could be explained with equal ease in both Freudian and Adlerian terms. So according to Freud, the first man suffered from repression, say, of some component of his Oedipus complex, while the second man had achieved sublimation. According to Adler, the first man suffered from feelings of inferiority, and so did the second man. I could not think of any human behavior which could not have been interpreted in light of either theory. It was precisely this fact that they always fitted, that they were always confirmed, which in the eyes of their admirers constituted the strongest argument in favor of these theories.
Hmm.
It began to dawn on me that this apparent strength was in fact their weakness.
Excellent.
So in his demarcation problem, he's not trying to come up with an essential definition of what science is. That doesn't matter. What he's trying to do is say, what is the distinguishing characteristic that separates Einstein's theories from Marx and Freud's theories? And the characteristic, or the main distinction, the important distinction, is that Einstein was able to say, if you go here and you look at this thing, look for this thing, and if you don't see it, my entire life's work is completely false. So more specifically, it was Arthur Eddington going out to look at a solar eclipse off the west coast of Africa in 1919, and if he didn't see light where Einstein said he would see light, then Einstein was completely wrong. And so Einstein's theories took risks, and the verification of his theory only mattered if it could have been falsified. And so to return to your essentialism concern, I don't think it's essentialism because it's not about answering what is the true essence of science. It's a criterion of demarcation. So it's a criterion that says, how do we distinguish between alchemy and chemistry, or astronomy and astrology? Because let's not forget that an astrologer can interpret anything that happens to them through the lights of astrology, right? And so this follows directly from the conversation about David Hume and the empiricists, because they would say that that which was scientific was precisely that which you had observations and evidence for. And the examples of Marx and of Freud kind of indicate that it's it's not about having observations of the that confirm your theory. It's about looking to falsify your theory, looking to disprove it. And this is where we get to the problem of induction and all that. But
I have a problem with the way I guess he writes it, because he's like assuming that there's this thing called science and there's this thing called metaphysics before explaining the problem. Whereas I think it would have been better to just say, at a given time, there like are a set of theories in front of you. And how do we start demarcating between the nonsense and the sense? Like, some of these theories are valid, they're helpful, they're true, they say, they make objective statements about the world. And some of these are just like not useful at all. And so we're just trying to like demarcate between what's useful and what's not useful. And so I think he should have saved the label like science and metaphysics for afterwards. And he says, I'm providing this criteria of demarcation. Now I'm just going to call everything on one side of this science and everything on one side of this metaphysics.
I'm imagining some diehard Popperians in the audience are going to object slightly to what you just said. So the demarcation criterion is not a criterion of meaningfulness, right?
No, I didn't say meaning. Oh, I said usefulness.
You say sense and nonsense? Yeah, so usefulness and sense and nonsense.
Well, no, sorry. Sense and nonsense when it comes to the predictive power. Yeah, sorry. I should have caveated that whole thing with, I'm talking in respect to like the extent to which they make predictions. So we have these theories and seemingly they're all just being confirmed by evidence all the time because of their predictions. And so how do we say which one of these are like good, are valid, are like actually enabling us to get like closer to truth, and which are not? But I think you calling me on the meaning thing is a good point to actually raise, because that is possibly the most common misconception, I think, when people are reading this chapter, is that Popper is saying that theories that are non-falsifiable or less falsifiable are like non-meaningful. And so here he's just providing, he is not saying anything about meaning. He's just talking about like science versus metaphysics. I'm just going to demarcate between them. Things can be, there's very meaningful metaphysical theories. And in fact, I mean, the whole criterion of demarcation, right? His whole falsifiability thing is itself unfalsifiable. So, and presumably still meaningful.
A common misconception about the falsifiability thing is just what you said. People say, well, you know, Popper's criterion is itself not falsifiable, so blah, 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 blah. And they think they caught him. And that's just like first sign that someone has no idea what the hell they're talking about when they're talking about Popper. Because he's a philosopher, and philosophy is itself not subject to experimental tests. Later on, we'll talk about how you can still say intelligent things about philosophical statements. But at least at this stage, he's only trying to demarcate the two things. He's not saying one is better or worse than the other. He's just saying how, like, what property distinguishes Einstein from Freud. And the falsification thing is his line of demarcation. And to tie it back to the problem of induction, we see that this is just a consequence of his solution to that problem, because his whole point is that we make these crazy guesses, we figure out what their consequences are, and then we check those consequences against reality. And if our check shows that the guess was wrong, then that's like reverse deductive inference. So your funnel analogy is great, because you can start with a general thing, you can funnel down to the specific thing, and then if the specific thing is not true, then you know the general thing is also not true. The whole funnel is just in the wrong spot, so you need a new funnel. And like, people think about Popper as being the falsification guy, but they should think of him as the guy who solved the induction problem. And falsification is just a nice, let's say, result or conclusion or practical thing that you get out of the solution to the problem of induction.
One thing I think he didn't cover super well in this chapter was, or at least maybe he doesn't say this anywhere, but it seems clear that falsifiability does have to be like not a Boolean value. It seems like it does have to be on a spectrum. I don't know if we talked about this offline or online before, but so some theories will be like more falsifiable than others. Oh, I think we have talked about this online. We talked about this long-termism, right? And that doesn't actually come across really in this chapter. I find it's sort of implied that it's more of like a yes-no type of question.
Or at least with the three theories under consideration in the chapter, it is more yes-no. And the yes-no-ness is, I think, a testament to Einstein's brilliance. And it's actually like the reason it's so Boolean is precisely because of Einstein's brilliance. He was able to create a theory which could be falsified by a single test. And so the reason we all rightly celebrate Einstein as being emblematic of like one of the most brilliant theoreticians that's ever lived is exactly because he was able to create a theory that had this Boolean falsifiability property. It's really, really hard to create a theory like that. And so in general, we are all not Einstein. And so our theories are going to be much more on the falsifiability spectrum. And the fact that it is a Boolean in this particular case is, I think, just testament to Einstein's brilliance.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it's true that, so it's a spectrum, but it's true that some theories will be at one and some will be at zero. Some like will just be like immediately falsifiable and some will just not be falsifiable whatsoever, like astrology. And so, yeah, while it is a spectrum, it's not to say that there aren't theories at and the extremes.
Yeah, and I guess another thing is like, you could take string theory or something, which is completely falsifiable, fine. But in practice, it's completely unfalsifiable because you can just keep changing all the parameters to account for any experimental result that you receive. And that's why it's kind of falling out of disfavor. But yeah, so there's also the practice versus theory distinction too, which is kind of elided. But as like the chapter which introduces the falsifiability criterion into the world, I think does a nice job of doing that up, and also just like setting up the rest of the book. So like the main things that the listener should have in mind when they go forward reading Popper is just that the problem of induction is the thing which is kind of underlying much of his writing. And falsification is one consequence, but many other things are going to come from his view of the solution to the problem of induction, such as the title and such as his view on myths and guesswork and stuff. And so if people are new to Popper, forget everything you knew about falsification and put in the problem of induction and see falsification as just one of the many things that come from his solution there. And I think that's a cleaner way into understanding just what his whole worldview is about.
Yeah, it's interesting. Do you think his solution to the problem of induction was prior to just his recognition of the importance of trial and error? Because like the way I have Popper in my mind is just this dude who was like, guess and check, trial and error, conjecture, reputation. That's literally the only way we know how to generate knowledge. And then he just took that concept and just went deep and just like took that thing, looked at ideas and was like, oh my God, this applies here. I'm able to solve this problem and this problem and this problem. Mm-hmm. He applied this to politics, to morality, to the problem of induction, you know, other areas of philosophy, etc. And so, but it sounds like you think he sort of started with this problem of induction and then moved from there.
I think that, yeah, so I should check. I'm sure he talks about this in his memoir, which I'm forgetting now, but my tentative guess is I think that the guessing and checking is his solution to the problem of induction. And then he realized how general that is. So in like the logic of scientific discovery, like the first thing he deals with is the problem of induction, as in conjectures and refutations, second half of the first chapter.
Also,
as
well as of knowledge, I guess.
Knowledge. And also realism and the aim of science. It's like half of this book. So in terms of output, I think he is probably just based on bulk alone is focused much more on the problem of induction than anything else.
He was probably just annoyed as fuck that no one was taking him seriously. He was like, I've literally solved this problem and no one gives a shit.
Imagine how annoying that would be, though, if like just writing everything as clearly as you possibly can and people just fucking ignore you. Like, they just ignore him. And then what can he do? Just keep writing about it and keep...
How many EA forum posts on long-termism do you think it'll take before we get to Popper's level of annoyance? Or just like, long-termism is insane, but no one's taking it seriously.
Well, like, when I saw the Wikipedia page, man, it blew my mind. Like, the fact that the statement about where scientific laws come from links to Oxford, but it's... Like, you click on the link and it's just like a definition. And even Wikipedia is usually pretty great because of the crowdsourcing thing.
Especially like for math and stuff, actually. Wikipedia is great. Yeah, because there's like a selection effect of like who's actually editing it. Yeah,
totally. Yeah, people like to insult Wikipedia, but like I think in general, it's a great source for information. Yeah. But in this particular instance, it think just indicates how deeply held is the misconception. Not to mention that undergraduate philosophy students are taught about the problem of induction as if it's still a problem.
Yeah, like, so funny. I was looking up like YouTube videos on the problem of induction in order to try and motivate this little reading group we're holding to get people excited with the problem, because it can seem like a little nebulous at first, you know.
Yeah,
and
totally.
You know, all the videos I were looking at would pose the problem and like give examples, And then I was waiting for like the big aha moment, but they're like, ah, but it's not a problem. And it never came. Yeah. The videos would just end. And yeah, they were like, this is a problem and no one knows how to solve it. Game over. And it was like, ah! I was like, what is happening? And someone just needs to edit like 30 seconds onto the end of each of these videos, being like, no, actually the problem's solved. And it's been solved for a while.
Well, and we haven't talked about it, like, and this is all of machine learning. Like,
oh yeah, true. We should talk about that. Yeah.
Hoping that if you just give enough data to deep models and enough data to, to DeepMind, then all of a sudden you're going to get AGI. But what is data? Data is just a sequence of observations. And Popper discusses this in a later chapter where he talks about an inductive machine. And the whole point is that if you give a machine data, you are determining what counts as a repeated observation. So all of the work of theorizing has already been done by the programmer and the data collector. And then it's possible to find statistical correlations in data sets and stuff. Of course, like that's what statistics is all about. But this is not inferring knowledge. This is pattern recognition after the game of selection has already been done, after the hard part's already been taken care of. And so not only is like Wikipedia and therefore the broader scientific community missing the point here, but also the entire field of machine learning and AI, my field, my dear field, if you think that we are going to get AGI based on training data and testing data, then you have not fully digested the significance of the intractability of inductive.
Or you just haven't made your neural net big enough. One more layer, baby.
That's true. That's all that's we true. Need. One more layer. but I don't know. I think this is a good summary of the first chapter. There's like a lot more to a lot of gems and a lot of just really brilliant examples that people should read for themselves. But I think the gist we've conveyed.
Nice.
This is, I think, one of the easier chapters if you get the problem of induction, and I think you're well on your way to understanding the rest of Popper's work. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, any last loose ends on your
end? I got nothing. At some point it would be fun to talk about like verisimilitude, because maybe I could see someone like sitting here being like, great, you've told me like, you know, you're talking about falsification, you're talking about how to like get rid of theories that aren't very good. But like then you might have all these ideas, these theories remaining, and like how do you actually go act in the world if you have like you just have all these a bunch of good theories that haven't yet been refuted by any observation. You know, it's like, what if you have 10 theories just sitting around that they can't be refuted yet or haven't been? Like, then what are you supposed to do? Are you supposed to act? And so it could be good to broach that at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My hunch is that verisimilitude doesn't work in the end.
Yeah, but exactly.
I don't understand all the details. It seems foundationalist to me, and the fact that, like, Deutsch was very careful to talk about explanations and not verisimilitude, and we can't mathematize which theories we're going to prioritize gives me makes me suspect that the project's ever going
to
work. But
I think it's been like proven to not work. Actually, I think it's like but it's just it proves that Popper's human, which is kind of refreshing. So it's nice. Yeah, he fucked up.
Yeah, he makes mistakes. Yeah, finally.
Yeah.
But thanks, man. This was fun.
Yeah, sweet.
Hopefully, we'll get this out before the Finn and Luca long-termism episode, just to break things up a little
bit. Yeah, that'd be good. But give people a break. Jesus. How much long-termism can one take?
One more long-termism episode, and then no more from us.
We'll see.
There's at least one more.
But if long-termism is true, you're going to have to be hearing about it for the next, like, 1 billion years, so.
All right, man. Well, it was fun.
Sweet.